Hannah Scott in the studio with us now, along with Aaron Granillo. Dozens of prosecutors across the country have signed a pledge to get an up-close look at the prisons that they send people to. That includes the King County prosecutor, too. And Hannah Scott talked to said prosecutor.
I did. And so what we're talking about here is 40 of the country's most progressive prosecutors, which, of course, includes King County prosecutor Dan Satterberg, who signed this pledge yesterday.
Begin to have our staff visit our state's prisons. Now, I've been going to prisons for decades myself and have learned a lot, but we haven't made this a priority for the people who work in prosecution.
Satterberg says he started visiting prisons back in law school and has continued since.
I've been going over the decades to meet with the men and women in prison, to hear their thoughts and ideas about reform of the criminal justice system and reform of the prisons. And also appreciate their own stories. Many of them will tell you their history and history of trauma, of disadvantaged upbringing, that they themselves were victims of crime many times before they made somebody else a victim of crime.
Now, he believes this is important for all prosecutors to have an understanding of what the conditions are in prison if they're going to be sending someone there.
It helps prosecutors understand when we're talking about 20-year terms or 30-year terms, we have to understand what exactly that means that we're imposing on another human being. To me, it's just about reality. We shouldn't be reluctant to understand what goes on in our prisons. In fact, it's something I think every taxpayer should want to know.
And he says there's historically been reluctancy among prosecutors to go in and actually see what's going on in the prisons that they send people to.
Why?
On a national level. There's no desire to see what goes on behind the curtain. It's kind of a lock up and throw away the key attitude, but it's something that he's, I know.
I don't understand. That'd be like being a doctor and not ever wanting to step inside of a hospital because you work at a clinic.
Think about it. The way, we're talking back in the 70s, 80s, tough on crime approaches. The idea is you just lock them up in a place you know they're on lockdown and good, they're out of the community.
Okay.
That's the idea. And it's an attitude that he has been working to change for some time, including here locally.
Now, 2 weeks ago, I had invited the elected prosecutors from Snohomish County and Kitsap County and a representative from Pierce County and our state association director. And all of us went into the Shelton prison to spend 2.5 hours talking with the Black Prisoners Caucus men who had an outline about criminal justice reform. And I think everybody went away with new respect for each other and for how a person can go into prison and become thoughtful and continue to have some hope, which would be a real challenge for a lot of us.
And he says this is not about wanting to encourage any prosecutors not to go after those long-term sentences or not to send people to jail or prison.
So, I mean, there are reasons we have prisons, right? I mean, for public safety and certainly for punishment. But by going in and talking to the people there, we can also begin to envision a prison system that maybe is a little bit more designed to help people make it one and done so they don't come back time and time again. Today, 1 out of 3 people who were released from prison are back in 3 years. And that's not something that anybody will predict when they're in prison. They all say they're never coming back, yet 1 out of 3 does. So we need to understand a little bit more about what goes on in prison.
So, and some of this, while you were out on maternity leave, I'd done a series where I got to really take a deep look into some of the diversionary programs that we have in when we're talking about youth criminal justice system. Mm-hmm. And so I asked him about that. And there's about 500 people in our youth juvenile justice system compared to 18,000 in our prisons in the state.
Wow.
So, but that is the idea. And that was really the message that I got in the series that I did, is that all of these people are going to get out at some point. And it's what do you want them to be like when they do come out? And in our juvenile system, we have a lot of programs in the lockup for juvenile facilities, where education and things that offer hope to these folks, not so much at the moment in our DOC, in our state system. So it's kind of about looking at that, any ways we might be able to improve that and improve outcomes, offer that hope to people, even if, they're serving 20, 30-year terms.
Hannah, did he talk about it all, the new or the recent state ombuds reports from the Department of Corrections? Because we heard a lot about the need for better health care, better food in the prisons. We know there have been food strikes among many prisoners across the Department of Corrections.
And just very loosely, and because I asked him about that, and I know that there are some state lawmakers who are going to have some legislation moving forward. There's been a lot of criticism of our state DOC. He's aware of that, and he says that's part of the reason to get all of his staff in there to see what's going on. He will have some a legislative agenda of his own coming up here in the next couple of weeks. He wasn't quite prepared to share that with me just yet.
Oh, okay. I was going to ask.
It's in the works.
Right.
Not quite ready.
But when he is ready to share that, He's going to share it with Hannah Scott. You can bet that.
These tours in the meantime, he's got about 500 staffers. He's going to start doing this starting in January, getting right on it.
Hey, and just to take a sharp turn here, I know you're headed off to a big hearing this morning, and we'll get more from you later in the afternoon, but why don't you tell the listeners what that's about?
Okay, that is going to be the first big court showdown over I-976. That's, of course, the $30 car tab measure approved by voters earlier this month. Basically, what they're asking, this is the Seattle King County folks asking for a preliminary injunction to stop the car tab measure from taking effect, which is supposed to take effect next Thursday, right? And the state attorney general has to defend this in court. He had filed a brief saying that really defending I-976. Yesterday afternoon, the city attorney filed a response to that saying, look, there's no way, if this is allowed to go in effect, there's no way to make the voters whole again with that money that they're going to spend. Mm-hmm. Where on the other side, on the flip side, if you do let them overpay for a little while, then we can, by continuing to pay car tabs as they are, then we can issue them refunds later down the line. That's what I know the setup is going this morning.
So we could have a ruling out of that hearing today. Maybe not. We'll see. Hannah
Scott.
Within
days, for sure.
We'll be reporting on that for you on Cairo Radio. A unique King County nonprofit is improving the lives of veterans. And Cairo Radio's Heather Bosch has our charity of the month.
It's estimated there are 18.2 million U.S. veterans among them.
Currently, there's like 1.4 million veterans of color, it's a little bit over a million of LGBTQ, a little bit over a million of women veterans, and as well as like 1.1 million non-religious minorities veterans.
Robert White with the nonprofit Minority Veterans of America says they face some unique challenges. For instance, gay or lesbian veterans who served during the Don't Ask, Don't Tell era might not know that they can get their discharges overturned and apply for veterans health care. His group helps them navigate the system. The group not only connects veterans with federal services, but those offered locally in King County.
We have to be the bridge between what the services are providing to the people who need it.
Making sure veterans are financially stable is another of his group's goals.
Making sure that veterans have the right jobs and are not underemployed, but are employed at the rate they should be paid at.
Above all, he says he wants minority veterans to feel supported and connected, which is sometimes a challenge, he says, particularly for women veterans.
Many times when you meet a woman veteran and they're with their husband, and people ask about the husband, where did your husband serve? But the husband typically may not even be a veteran or ever serve. So women veterans are, you know, they're not being seen correctly.
Minority Veterans of America hold social activities, too.
Having social engagement events, getting together, building that community.
And a place to belong. Minority Veterans of America is Cairo Radio's Charity of the Month.
That's Heather Bosch reporting. Hey, oh. Time for Choke Points, brought to you by Toyota of Puyallup. It's time for your Turkey Day pregame pep talk from our traffic coach. Chris has everything you need to know about avoiding the worst traffic of the week. All right, coach, take it away.
All right, and I'm going to start with what I say every holiday, but it is really the only real absolute when it comes to traffic. To avoid sitting and sucking fumes on the freeway, you need to leave early or you need to leave late.
Now, that doesn't sound like a coach to me, Sully. Come on, bear down. Let's do it.
Well, okay. Leave early or leave late. Come on.
Yeah. Let's go, team.
I mean, because you don't want to be on the roads when everybody else is. It's pretty simple. So you need to decide if you can leave really early in the morning when you're going, or perhaps maybe even a day early, or maybe really late or a day late. Say, okay, for instance.
So what would, if you were the driver, what would you do?
I would probably leave tonight at 8 o'clock.
Okay. 8 p.m.
Okay. 8 p.m.
Wow.
So that way, you know, anybody, you know, a lot of kids might not have school tomorrow as well. Some do, some don't.
Yeah.
And so what you don't want to be doing is traveling like at 10 o'clock to 8 o'clock tomorrow after during the entire day. You don't want, no. So if you can leave tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. or leave at 8 p.m. or maybe you even wait till Thanksgiving morning, depending on where you're going, because you don't want, because most everybody is going to be on the road tomorrow afternoon.
Unless they listen to you.
Correct, because Wednesday is by far the worst travel day before Thanksgiving. So if you're going using I-5 southbound from Tacoma to Lacey, the Department of Transportation says you can expect normal volumes, heavier than normal volumes, basically from 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. tomorrow. I mean, 10 hours of a lot heavier traffic. But it doesn't really get back to its regular volumes until about 10 p.m. at night. Think about that. I mean, that's a lot of people just on that stretch. But WashDOT's Kara Mitchell says you should make sure your car is ready for stop-and-go traffic and prepared for long waits.
For Thanksgiving holiday travel, give yourself plenty of time to get to Grandma's house or wherever you're going. Watch the weather conditions.
One thing that drivers can be thankful for on the drive through Tacoma is that all of the new HOV connections between I-5 and Highway 16 opened over the weekend. So that means a lot of the weaving and merging should be going away.
If you live in Gig Harbor, you can jump onto the HOV lane and go eastbound and take that HOV lane all the way to I-5 without merging in and out of any lanes.
Same goes for southbound I-5. You can now go straight from the HOV lane on I-5 to the HOV lane on westbound Highway 16. But Mitchell says you can still expect big delays in the construction zone just before that as you get across the Puyallup River Bridge.
We can go from HOV to HOV. We still have the project by the Puyallup River that is building a new southbound I-5 Puyallup River Bridge. Once that is complete, we will be able to open up the full HOV system from Fife into Tacoma.
But that's not for at least another 2.5 years. Now, eastbound I-90 drive, usually quite bad on the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, too. You can expect nearly double the normal traffic between North Bend and Cleellum during the afternoon. Eastbound Highway 2 sees heavier volumes as well, but it's nowhere near as bad as the other routes. The one thing that you really need to prepare for is returning home, because you have a little flexibility on when you go, but most everybody comes home on Sunday. So you don't want any part of any road on Sunday. So that's why maybe you should leave Saturday night, maybe Saturday morning, maybe come back a day early. That allows you to kind of relax, get your laundry done, you know, do whatever you need to do. But yeah, you don't want any part of the roads on Sunday. That's really when go early or go late can really help you out. And also ferries, too. I mean, expect 2-hour delays getting back in the eastbound direction Saturday, Sunday as well. So, yeah, try to offset your trip if you can. Heck, even come back Monday.
It just means a shortened or, as you said, extended holiday.
Yeah.
What's the worst? Because I was talking to a parent at the bus stop the other day. So we waited for our kids and he went, oh, Tacoma. It just sounds like Tacoma. And then is it Cleellum? They're notorious for bad traffic.
Right. Going east on I-90 is going to be terrible. I mean, it always is. It's going to be like a Friday afternoon all day tomorrow. Same with the drive getting through Tacoma and JBLM. It doesn't really loosen up until you get almost to 101 in the Olympia area as well. So those two drives are by far the worst.
You're going north?
We do have some people going into Canada, okay. So there is, you should expect some extra delays there getting across the border as well. One thing we do have to factor into this is the Apple Cup is Friday and it's here. So there might be more people coming westbound on I-90 than you might anticipate, saying if you're thinking about coming back early from a trip over the mountains for Thanksgiving. If you're coming back Friday, expect to see a lot of Cougar traffic heading here for Apple Cup on Friday.
Are you here tomorrow?
Yes.
All right.
Of course I am.
You're going to have your traffic coach here as you head out on your Thanksgiving holiday.
Yeah, thanks, exactly.
Son. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Paid family leave. Washington State was one of the leaders in setting up a family leave program, and the idea was to help working mothers continue working so their careers could catch up with men. They wouldn't have to take 6 months off, for example. Well, a new study has been done into whether family leave is working or not. Elena Patel conducted it. And Elena, first give me a feel for how you went about this. How'd you gather the data?
We used administrative tax data to follow moms who had experience with California paid leave.
What did the study ultimately find?
So the study finds that for new mothers who first had access to paid leave in 2004, that they actually have a reduction in employment and a reduction in wages. And the surprising thing is that this persists for 10 years after they've given birth.
Mm. And what was the cause of that reduction? Was it self-reduction because they wanted to continue to spend more time with their children, or was it employer-forced reduction?
Yep, it's a great question, and it's something we try to disentangle. The truth is that the tax data don't speak directly to this, but there are a lot of clues about what the dominant force is likely to be. So, for example, what we analyze is the wages that your employee pays you, and that doesn't list how many hours you work. It just says you made $30,000 or $40,000 a year. And so some of the decrease in wages could reflect moms choosing to work part-time instead of full-time. So their wages will look like they're falling, but actually they're opting out. At the same time, because we don't find an impact on moms who gave birth birth to their second, third, or fourth child in 2004 suggests that discrimination is not likely to be the driving force. It's hard to imagine that an employer is explicitly not promoting and hiring women who've had their first birth compared to all the moms in 2004. And then finally, we use census data because the tax data can't really speak to sort of bonding and relationships between mother and child. We use census data, and we do find that the women who had access to paid leave in 2004 were more likely to read to their children, to eat breakfast with their children, and to take them on outings. And so all of this together kind of suggests that the extra 6 weeks that you have at home with your kids because of California's paid leave is actually allowing a mother to improve the relationship that she has with her child, and that is having a preference impact on her later in life, where she might be switching to part-time employment and is bonding better with her kids.
So it would lead people to believe the results of your study that, hey, paid family leave is not helping women, so we don't have to pay women. But you're saying, no, don't do that. What are you suggesting?
Yep, I think that's a really nearsighted conclusion would say paid family leave is bad for women if you read our paper. I think what we're trying to make sure that people focus on and what the policy goal is. So a policy goal of paid leave can be to improve attachment for women, and it might be happening for some women, but I think the bigger policy goal of paid leave is to think harder about the well-being of families and kids. You do see that kids and moms are faring better when they have access to paid leave, and it also in particular when the dads take a portion of paid leave.
So what it's done is allowed women to make that choice. And the problem you have is that the choice to go back to work is measurable in dollar terms. The choice to stay with your family is not measurable. How do you prevent people from just looking at the numbers and completely misinterpreting your study?
Yep, and that's been something we've focused hard on. When we came to realize what the results were going to be, that there's going to be this negative impact on wages, we did think hard about how to make sure that the tone and the pitch of the academic paper that we wrote and also sort of all these conversations that we're having is not fixated just on the wage earning. So, for example, a positive outcome that you can see in the data is new mothers switching out of a traditional wage employee job and into these more flexible work arrangements that are more conducive to, you know, raising a child.
But from a company's perspective, they're still losing an employee that they then have to rehire for.
Yep.
And that's kind of a nagging annoyance. So how do you convince companies to adopt paid family leave policies when their state doesn't enact a law to do so?
Yep. And I think that that's just a public policy struggle that we struggle with as a society, that this is a cost. Having children, there is a wage gap that emerges. Moms just earn less once they have kids compared to dads who have kids. And helping companies realize that the overall well-being of their employees is an important aspect of their company policy.
And I also want to raise something else, too, about the study and what we've read about it that might be a silver lining is that your study took place between 2004 and 2014. I think that that was largely before we began these discussions about the societal pressures on mothers, the, you know, second shift that mothers were doing a lot of the home care as well. And that's now being more and more we're going towards more of an equal partnership between father and mother. And also dads staying home as well. So I think today you might find different data if you look at families.
Oh, and that's a totally fair point. And I just want to emphasize that the take up for dads in 2004 was very low. We see 3-4% of dads taking paid leave. And there's other studies by Maya Rossenslater and other people looking in this that do find that the dad take up in particular has increased quite a bit since 2004.
I mean, thank goodness.
So our results, I agree, thank goodness. Paid leave was not tasked with the intention of being a program for women. It was really meant to be a gender neutral policy. But to the extent that we don't encourage men or partners to take this program, it had very gendered effects at the start. So in some European countries, they give you dads an extra month of leave that's use it or lose it. It doesn't go to the mom unless the dad is the one that has to take it. Maybe when you're designing a new policy, you might want to take these things into consideration with the design.
And that tells me this needs to be a consistent national policy. Since it's not something that businesses can easily measure, it simply has to be one of the fundamental rules of the game that everybody follows for the overall good of the country.
And actually, to that point, my inner tax economist can't help but mention that the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017 did allow for a business tax credit for 2 years for companies to offer paid family leave. So it subsidizes the cost to employers of offering paid leave. And after 2 years, then the GAO will evaluate the effectiveness of this, and Congress will decide if they want to extend the credit. So this is really the first step in federal policy land of trying to figure out how we might implement this at a federal level. And that's already going on. This is an experiment that's underway right now.
Based on the way Americans value work ethic and 80-hour work weeks and, you know, and that sort of an attitude, how do you think the debate's going to go over on a federal policy for parental leave?
You know, I think that the evidence has come down consistently in favor of improved well-being as a result of this paid family leave, and it's really just a matter of everybody kind of getting on board on that. Paid leave is not a silver bullet for the gender wage gap, but it is helpful for families and their well-being.
Well, I can tell you this much. Between my first pregnancy 6 years ago and this pregnancy 6 months ago, and my company just in the last year, year and a half, enacted 6 weeks paid leave. And then I think next year, all of Washington State will have a paid portion.
That's right.
There is a marked difference between my dedication to the company, my mental health, my physical health, and my connection to this child at this point in her life. So, you know, anecdotal, but I can be one of those advocates to say that it took a lot of the stress and tension out of my family dynamic to know that I had a safety net in that paid family leave.
Yep.
That's good news for me because I don't want to have to work with a co-host who's constantly under stress all the time.
I might still go cry in the closet. That's the hormones still draining from my body, Dave.
Elena Patel is professor at the University of Utah's Department of Finance and one of the co-authors of the study that looked into the long-term effects of California's Paid Family Leave Act. Elena, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, 6 months postpartum and we're still getting back on track.
Today's dose takes us to Bell, California, where the Shelter Partnership shares donations to some 200 nonprofits across the state helping people in need. Jennifer Marquez is with the shelter, which just received its largest donation in its nearly 35-year history.
These are much-needed items that normally agencies would have to buy themselves, so this is a very important donation.
The items may seem simple. They're just bars of soap. 2 million bars, to be precise. A couple from Sherman Oaks made the donation.
Our want was to create a brand with a heart that connected consumers with the cause.
Donna Mullis and Ronnie Sugar co-founded Raw Sugar Living, a company they founded 4 years ago with the very intention of giving back. They spoke with KNBC in Los Angeles.
If we could help inspire people to look for a better job, to feel better about themselves.
My mother always told me that we help ourselves by helping others.
So one of the recipients of this soap is the Union Rescue Mission, where Alexandra Monzi-Baez works. It's the very agency that got her back on her feet after she struggled with addiction and homelessness.
People, just because they are experiencing homelessness doesn't mean they don't want to be clean. They want the same things that we do when we're living in our own place.
And Ronnie Sugar says he hopes his company's efforts inspires others to give back, donate, or just do something kind during the season of giving.
And maybe show people that being inspired and doing good, it rubs off and you'll have that next person that will pay it forward.
And as the company shows, it really doesn't take that much to do something nice this season. Just soap, shampoo, something just to give back.
I remember, too, in working with the Salvation Army in Spokane, one of the board members there, he and his friends, anytime they travel and they stay at a hotel or motel, whatever, they, instead of using the soap that's there or what they don't use, they keep in a bag and they donate to the Salvation Army, because even just those little bars of soap that go unused that you might leave there or just take and then they collect dust in your drawer, those can be used too at shelters. So maybe a good idea next time our listeners go out and travel. Thank you, Aaron. Time for our Sports Insider from 710 ESPN Seattle. You can hear Stacy Rost weekdays at noon on Tom, Jake, and Stacy. Good morning, Stacy.
Good morning.
So, we'll get to Seahawks in a moment because we have some injury report there and MVP talk. But the Mariners, big news, they've signed a young man, $24 million contract, first base, never played in the big league. Why are they taking a chance on him?
Not only that, I think the interesting thing about Evan White, who's the first baseman that they signed, is that he's never played more than four games. Let's just say he's never played at the AAA level, which is the level below the big leagues. So he's not the first player in the minors to be signed to a big contract, but he's the first player in the minors to be signed to a big contract that hasn't even played at kind of like your junior level. So it's a risky move, I think, for the Mariners. I think that's what what a lot of people are seeing it as. But Jerry DePoto, the Mariners general manager, I'm sure is hoping that it pays off for the Mariners and that they sign someone they believe is their first baseman of the future and potentially one of their best defensive players. And they save money long term by signing him now.
So what's the hype around this guy? Why does he deserve all of this money? I mean, we've heard of, you know, other players coming up, people like, you know, Bryce Harper and other young guys who actually have some credentials coming up. I've never heard of Evan White.
Yeah, he was drafted 17th, I think, out of Kentucky in the amateur draft. And he is, I think, widely considered the best defensive first baseman. So I think that that played a big part in it. I think that besides Kyle Lewis, Jerry DePoto and the Mariners see Evan White as their kind of like second best big hitter. And I think it's interesting to watch this team come together because they, I don't know a better way to say it than they're just kind of like starting from scratch with this team. Evan White is now the only Mariner that signed through 2021. And so this team very much is rebuilding their future and building up a roster. And we don't know what a lot of these pieces are going to look like yet. So a lot of the guys that they're counting on for the future, like Jared Kelnick, Julio Rodriguez, and now Evan White, not only have we not seen them in the bigs, but we haven't seen a lot of them in the minors, at least locally, like AAA Tacoma. So it really is something where it we have yet to see everything that the Mariners see in these guys, but clearly they have a ton of faith in them. So I'm really, really interested to see what they bring. I think you guys should be too, because I think that there's a good chance Evan White gets a chance at the bigs this upcoming season.
Well, I'll always root for the Mariners. Did I make you commit to a year for the always. Mariners going to the World Series? Did you say 2025?
You did.
Okay.
Yes. Well, I think I said 2024. I'm going to keep changing it the better they get.
I'll remember these things. I said 2022.
I'm pretty sure.
Audio recordings to hold against you. Quickly about the Seahawks injury report. We've got Jadeveon and Clowney and Jaron Reed both injured before Monday Night Football. There's some time, though, to heal.
Yeah, you got a week, and I think I'm a bit more optimistic about Jadeveon Clowney. He has a sports hernia-like issue. Pete Carroll said it's kind of like a sports hernia. I don't know what that means, but it's kind of like a sports hernia. And he went to see a specialist when the team went to Philadelphia. Pete Carroll said it's not something he needed surgery for, so I'm assuming it's on the minor end of that. So the hope is that he'll play Monday. Jaron Reed, they aren't even going to give us an update on until Friday. So I'm slightly less optimistic about him, but he has a sprained ankle.
Hey, Stacey, I want to talk about last night's Monday Night Football game, because Lamar Jackson is pretty much putting Russell Wilson's MVP chances to a close, it looks like.
Oh, man, that Lamar Jackson was lights out last night. It was like Russell Wilson's three worst games of the season, and worst games for Russell Wilson are like the best games ever for Mitch Trubisky. So just keep that in mind. But three of Russell Wilson's lowest graded games, two of them were in the last 2 weeks for Seattle. And so it doesn't really help that Lamar Jackson in prime time just puts on like a clinic and looks out of this world. And I was thinking, we have a text thread, me and the guys on the show, and we were all saying the same thing of like, ooh, you wanted Baltimore to win and beat the Rams, but you also wanted Russell Wilson's MVP case to stand, and it took a huge hit. So I don't know. Russell Wilson has a shot, right? He's got the next 2 weeks for him are in primetime. So he has a chance to turn it around, too.
Thank you, Stacey, our sports insider. You can hear her weekdays at noon on Tom, Jake, and Stacey on 710 ESPN. Talk to you tomorrow.
Thanks, guys.
Tuesday mornings, we go live to our nation's capital and Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter David Farenthold at The Washington Post. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
So, I wanted to discuss this playbook that leaked from the Texas Republican Party. The Dallas Morning News got a hold of this. And what was surprising to see, or maybe not, is that it sounds like the Texas Republicans are trying to distance themselves, perhaps, from the president, saying that they need to mitigate the polarizing nature of President Trump. What did you think about that? And also, are you seeing this on the national stage over in D.C.?
I was really surprised. Obviously, Texas is a big battleground for 2020, not just on the presidential level. Obviously, Democrats would love to have those electoral votes, but also on a state level. Texas's legislature is, I think, 83-67 Republican, but Democrats, who made huge gains in 2018 in kind of the Beto O'Rourke mania, they have designs on actually flipping the Texas State House for, I don't know how many, the first time in I don't know how many years. So what this document you referenced was the Republicans' game plan to beat this. And yeah, you know, for as much as people say in public, Republicans say in public about Trump drives up our turnout, he's our best campaigner, he's our best salesman, they seem to think that Trump was a net negative. And they were sort of saying, how can we combat both the polarizing nature of his presidency, but also, you know, what do we do if he, you know, discourages people so much that Republicans don't turn out?
Is that the case? Is that what's being projected, that Republicans just won't go to the polls and vote because they don't want to vote for President Trump?
Well, you know, we're a year out, so it's hard to know. But a couple of examples recently, and these couple of red state gubernatorial elections in Louisiana and Kentucky, those are red states won by huge margins by Trump in 2016. And you saw recently in governor's elections, Trump came and said, this is this governor's election, you know, I'm not on the ballot, but this is a referendum on me. And Republicans here in these states, you love me, come vote for me. And the Republicans lost in both those cases because Democrats increased their turnout. Trump had alienated so many people that they became Democrats and voted in big numbers, and Republicans didn't rise as much. So Trump wasn't actually on the ballot in those cases, and I think the Republicans think, well, when Trump's really on the ballot, it'll change things. But it shows that his magic may have worn off a little bit 3 years in.
You had three big pieces recently about the president's properties. Who's booking Mar-a-Lago? Who's staying at his D.C. hotel? And how much is the Secret Service spending now at Trump properties?
The thing that blew me away was the last one you mentioned, Secret Service spending at Trump properties. Now, Trump goes to his properties a lot, which is fine. That's his, you know, that's his prerogative. But what we didn't know until now was, okay, so many Secret Service agents follow Trump wherever he goes. And obviously, while he's out playing golf, they're sitting around and they need to eat. They need rooms to put their stuff in. We were trying to figure out how much money does Trump charge? How much does Trump charge the taxpayers for the Secret Service agents that have to follow him? When they go to his properties, how much does he charge them? We had no idea until now because the Secret Service had been fighting every request for documentation. Well, they finally gave up some last week. And it was only for the first 5 months of 2017. That's how long they've been fighting this. But it showed something that astounded me, which was that even when Trump just goes to play golf for a day at his golf course in Virginia, he doesn't stay overnight, he doesn't travel a long distance, the Secret Service pays Trump about $30,000 just for that one trip. And again, this is not what do they spend protecting Trump. This is what do they pay directly to Trump. What does Trump charge them for the people who are there to protect him? $30,000 for one round of golf. And the pace in that period was like $2,000 a day the Secret Service was paying Trump directly. It just shows what was, we didn't understand. He is using these trips as a way to put money in his own pocket.
Is it? Can you say that definitively, that that is his motive?
I don't know what his motive is, I should say. There's two decisions here. The first is, where does he go as president? Where does he travel? And presidents obviously can travel wherever they want. The second part, though, is there's more discretion, and that is, what does he charge the Secret Service? That's within his prerogative, or at least within his business's prerogative. If he wants to, he wants to give them their food for free, he wants to give them their food for a penny apiece, certainly he has that ability, and he wasn't doing it. He was charging them money. So whatever his reason for traveling there was, he has a decision on the back end about how much to bill these people that have to be there, how much to bill the taxpayers for these people that have to be there. And it was a pretty exorbitant bill. I don't know how you spend $29,000 in one day of golf. You know, what are you buying in that context? So we don't know, actually. I'd like to know more about that. But it shows that Trump is choosing to bill these people quite a lot, to bill you and me, the taxpayer, quite a lot for the people that follow him.
Yeah. And you have been following the money for ever since President Trump took office. The long-sought tax returns, though, have yet to be turned over. There seemed to be some movement on that when the Manhattan DA was granted access to those tax returns. But then the Supreme Court stepped in and put a stay on that until they decide if they're going to hear the case. So where are we as far as, you know, why did the Supreme Court step in, put a stay on that? And could we eventually see those tax returns?
We could eventually see them. This is sort of the inevitable conclusion of the many different folks who are trying to get Trump's tax returns. The two most notable examples being a House committee asking to review them, which it says under law they can, and the Manhattan DA asking to see them as part of a broader investigation into possible campaign finance violations. And in both those cases, Trump has sued the people who want his tax returns, saying they don't have a right to them. It's funny, actually. He told Congress, well, you can't have them. Only the law enforcement can have them. And when law enforcement asked him, he said, no, law enforcement, you can't have them. It's only for Congress. So both those cases are headed for the Supreme Court now, which is what we sort of thought all along. The key there will be Trump has made this really expansive assertion of his own authority, basically that while he's president, he's like an emperor, that nobody can investigate him for anything at all except for Congress and the impeachment process. No law enforcement can investigate him for any reason at all while he's president. I don't know if the Supreme Court is likely to agree with that, but we're going to see. This is a Supreme Court with two Trump justices. We'll see how they react to this sweeping assertion of authority.
What exactly does the Manhattan DA think they will find in those tax returns?
Well, they have not said very much about that, and they have said that it's possible they won't find anything they find useful, and definitely they won't show them to the public right when they get them. What they're investigating is these payments that were made to Stormy Daniels, the adult film star, right before the 2016 election to basically buy her silence about this affair she alleged with Trump. That led to Michael Cohen going to prison on federal charges. Now the Manhattan DA is sort of seeing whether state laws were broken. So he's interested in how money moved through the Trump organization to pay off Michael Cohen, who paid off Stormy Daniels. And I suppose that the tax returns might show some evidence of that.
Hey, Dave, we've been following the news this morning about former White House counsel Don McGahn. He is now appealing a decision by a federal judge that says he has to testify before House Democrats. Can the White House actually stop Don McGahn from testifying? He doesn't work there anymore.
That's right, and that's sort of the heart of this case. He's actually not the president's lawyer anymore. It's interesting, this case is not just about whether Don McGahn, you know, has to spill what he knows. He's saying he doesn't even have to sort of decline in person. He doesn't have to show up in person and say no. He should not even be required to go into the House. In this case, McGahn's lawyer has said he will comply unless the decision is stayed for an appeal. And the Justice Department is now trying to appeal on President Trump's behalf. So we'll see if an appeals court wants to touch this. The lower court's ruling was pretty definitive. You know, presidents aren't kings. There's no exemption from testifying just because you used to work for the president.
All right, we'll keep an eye on it. Thank you, David Farenthold at The Washington Post.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.